I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, and I'm the co-founder of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. My co-host Claudia Wu is out sick today. Claudia, we're sending healthy vibes over the airways to you. Hope you're feeling better. We have a brand new sponsor for Radio Cherry Bomb that we are very excited about, Ecole Chocolat. Ecole is an online school for those looking to become chocolate makers or chocolate experts. The cool thing is that you can study at your own pace. I've been checking out their website, and I have to say I'm very intrigued. I love chocolate, and if you listen to the show regularly, you know that Claudia has talked a lot about her passion for dark chocolate, so we might just have to sign up for some of those classes. You can check out the site at ecolechocolat.com. Apologies to the French speakers out there if I'm butchering that. And if you just happen to become a big, famous chocolate maker, you can be a guest on Radio Cherry Bomb one day. So, today's show, we have two very different guests joining us. First up is Alexandra Duquesne, the founder of Pointy Snout Caviar. And after the break, we'll be talking to Joy the Baker, the popular blogger and cookbook author and creator of the hot new Instagram account, Drake on Cakes. Alex, I'm sure you look at Drake on Cakes all the time, right?
I don't actually.
So, unlike cake or Drake, caviar is not something most of us probably enjoy on a regular basis. As Anaïs Nin wrote of June Miller in the first volume of her diary, she makes use of the soft of the bread for a napkin. She falls asleep at times with shoes on unmade beds. When the little money comes in, June buys delicacies, strawberries in the winter, caviar, and bath salts. Caviar is a luxury item and one steeped in history. The first known recipe for making caviar dates back to 1564 from a writer in Venice. A bit of controversy surrounds caviar today, too, because of the dwindling population of sturgeon, the fish most associated with caviar production. But Alexandra and her partner decided to create a sustainably farmed caviar produced right here in the United States. Before getting into the fish egg business, Alexandra founded one of the world's premier fashion and advertising photo agencies, with offices in New York, Paris, and Los Angeles, producing global marketing campaigns for Fortune 500 companies such as BMW, Seagram, and AT&T. So, Alex, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you, Carrie. My pleasure to be here.
So, of all the businesses you could have gotten into, why caviar?
Well, we were sitting on a beach in Lamu in the Indian Ocean, wondering what to do with the rest of our lives. We had several careers in very unrelated fields, and we happened to have a large half-kilo tin of caviar we had brought with us from the U.S. And we were sitting with our feet in the ocean at dusk, surrounded by little children playing in the water, eating caviar with plastic gelato spoons, and looking at the ocean, the Indian Ocean, and really sort of thinking hard about how can we make an impact on the world and how can we continue to do things with interesting people that will keep us fulfilled in some way, because we were surrounded by interesting people. I mean, from Doctors Without Borders to defrocked priests and rock and roll people sort of hanging out on this island. And because we didn't have a trust fund, basically, with which to sort of fund philanthropic activities and charities and so on that we care about, we decided that, A, we had to start a business that would then help us fund things that we care about. But, B, what we really wanted to do was to sort of look at the whole idea of luxury in a different way, to take the bling out of luxury, to make it experiential. And looking at the ocean, it drew us into thinking about something that we care very deeply about, which is the pollution, the lack of good drinking water on the planet. And literally out of the blue, this idea came. Well, let's do something that connects the ocean and actually connects fish and pollution and the thing that is causing fish to die, causing the sturgeon to die. And we happen to be eating caviar. Let's do something with caviar. And it was really that spontaneous.
So let's go back a second. We love career changers here at Radio Cherry Bomb. You said you've had several different careers in the past. What were some of those?
I've always been involved in the arts. I grew up with artists. My parents were both artists. I grew up in Europe at a time when there were some very notable people in my family and surrounding my family life. I went from that to, eventually I went to art school myself in London, but I didn't want to be a painter. I came to New York and I spent a year studying drama with Stella Adler, and I didn't want to be an actress. I became very involved in fashion in London for many years, dabbled in film. We made a little home movie one day, 15-minute film, and showed it to some friends in New York. And my friend said, well, you must meet my husband tomorrow because he's doing a little music festival. I'm sure he'd love you to film it. And that turned out to be, I've just gone blank, Woodstock.
I thought you were going, I was like, she's not going to say Woodstock. And yes, it was Woodstock.
It was Woodstock. So we were hired to film Woodstock, and we were up there for 3 months, 2 months before and a month after and throughout, of course, the festival. So there was that sort of shift from fashion to film. And then not long after, I was at a dinner party.
Okay, wait, you have to talk about Woodstock a little. We can't let you not tell us about Woodstock. So what, I mean, granted, you were there working.
Yes.
So your experience was a little different, although I guess the bands were working
really.
Too, right? Just tell us something about Woodstock.
Well, it was, I mean, no one knew what was, in fact, going to happen. But I think really the most interesting thing was being with the people who put the production together in the weeks going up to it. There was just an extraordinary feeling of instantaneous spontaneity and getting things to work when everything indicated that it couldn't possibly work. There was such a high level of true warmth and the embracing of one another in terms of making this project happen. And then, of course, when the gates and the walls fell down, it was pure joy, pure absolute joy and happiness throughout.
Does one performance stand out?
Well, I was on the stage the famous last morning, Monday morning, and that, I think, really was extraordinary. From Santana to Jimi Hendrix was astonishing, and I will always remember it.
Wow, I have goosebumps just thinking about that. Gosh. Okay, so I forgot. What are we talking about? Caviar?
Caviar, yes. So then after
we could have you back to talk about Woodstock for like a whole hour, probably.
Caviar, but, career changes.
Yes. So post-Woodstock.
Post-Woodstock, as I was saying, I happened to be at a dinner table and I was sitting next to a very famous art director by the name of Bob Cato, whom you may remember. And he turned to me and asked me what I was doing. And I said, nothing, I'm actually wondering what I should do. And he said, well, I think you should become a photographer's agent. And a photographer was sitting at our table, and another famous agent was sitting there. And he said, he can train you for a few days. And I said, oh, okay, that seems like a good idea. And so I did. And that's what I did for 20 years.
Wow.
But it was really a case of things presenting themselves to me in my life. I never actually set out to either become an agent or a filmmaker or a caviar brander and marketer. It was just moments that happened, and I went with them.
So now that you're in the caviar business, it seems like such a complicated item to bring to market. How did you even begin building your company?
Well, after we had the idea and we decided we were going to do this, we spent about a year literally researching. We met producers all over the world. We went to farms all over the world. And we networked with a lot of people, a lot of creative people that we know in Los Angeles and Shanghai and London and Paris and New York. And we spent a year talking about it amongst ourselves and with them. A lot of thought went into the creation of the brand and how to position it. And what we all understood was that, you know, caviar is a very traditional product, and there's a lot of formality around it historically in the way people enjoy it or at least partake in it. Lots of rules. And what we decided was we wanted to make it fun, accessible, whimsical. We wanted to get rid of the tradition and get rid of the rules and say, you know, you can have caviar in bed at 2 o'clock in the morning with a Coca-Cola. It's just such a sensual thing. It's so fun to eat. It makes you feel so good. Have it with a whiskey at a bar after dinner. You don't have to have a starched tablecloth and a butler and a little drum roll. You can really have it any time. Yes, it's expensive, and it should be expensive because it's rare and it's precious. But at the same time, it's such a wonderful experience.
So let's talk about the sustainability aspect of it. So you decided to focus on sustainably raised sturgeon that was being farmed here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So just tell us a little bit about how you even began to find these farms, the research that went into that.
Well, there was one very important person that we hooked up with early on who's really the pioneer in sturgeon aquaculture, and he taught us a great deal. He ran for 30 years one of the largest farms in the U.S. And first of all, I should explain what sustainability means in terms of aquaculture. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has established parameters in that the ideal goal when farming fish is to grow fish with a one-to-one ratio in terms of the amount of wild fish you use to grow 1 pound of farmed fish. And to give an example, farmed salmon is the most unsustainable thing. It takes 5 pounds of wild fish to grow 1 pound of salmon. Whereas the farm that we ended up primarily working with for the first few years, through their scientific research and their collaboration with the University of California, have managed to get that ratio almost down to a one-to-one. Mm-hmm. That sustainability is, of course, hugely important in terms of maintaining the balance in the world. So for us, everything we do is about sustainability. I mean, in our own lives, we do as much as we can. The farm in California actually helps when the rivers, the wild population in the rivers begin to diminish through very controlled releases. They actually put fingerlings back into the rivers to maintain the population. As you know, in the Caspian, the entire ecosystem there has been completely decimated in the last 20 years.
And the Caspian being where sturgeon have traditionally been harvested for their roe.
So there's virtually no wild sturgeon left, and there's no caviar being produced from wild sturgeon.
At all anymore?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
Virtually none. 99% of all the caviar in the world now is farmed.
Wow.
And from many different countries, not just the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Has you mentioned the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They have that fantastic seafood watch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have they taken a position on American-raised caviar?
Well, I think everyone's position is the same with any foodstuff.
A rating. Have they come out and rated?
No, they haven't.
No, not yet.
However, the American caviar that is being produced now in this country is every bit as good as wild. And I think probably better than most farms in the world.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the offerings from Pointy Snout.
We have two different types, two species of sturgeon. One is white sturgeon, which is from the Pacific Northwest and native to that area. And one is Ocetra, which is produced in this country now for the first time. It's only been produced here for 3 years. Ocetra comes from only one sturgeon, and it is very often mislabeled. People call all kinds of different things Ocetra, and it actually isn't, which is one of the big problems with what one can actually find as a consumer if one's looking to buy good quality caviar. The Ocetra comes from Asipenser Guldenstetti, otherwise known as Russian sturgeon, has nothing to do with Russia, as opposed to Siberian sturgeon, which has nothing to do with Siberia, and Siberian is often called Ocetra, but it's not. So we offer true Ocetra in two different grades, and we offer true, very, very good white sturgeon in two different grades. The white sturgeon is very similar to Ocetra.
So if you've never bought caviar before, where do you even start?
You have to find a trusted vendor. And how does one trust a vendor if one's never bought caviar before? Well, the usual sources would be through one's peers, social media, research on the internet. Because it's really, really difficult for a novice to buy something that costs a lot of money in a jar, and you've no idea what is inside that jar. So the only thing you can do is really trust the source that you're buying it from, and believe that when the source says this is truly high-grade Ocetra, it is, and that it has no additives. Most of the caviar that is imported from other countries has borax as a preservative. It's not always noted on the label. It's not always acknowledged or admitted. It's not legal in this country because it is a carcinogen. So it's not used at all by American producers.
Okay.
So something to watch out for when you're buying from other countries is just be aware that it might have borax in it, even if it doesn't say so. Production methods in other countries might not be as well controlled as they are in this country. So I always promote American-produced caviar versus any others.
So Valentine's Day is right around the corner. So if someone
yes.
wants to buy some caviar for Valentine's Day and serve it, what is a great way to serve caviar?
Well,
you said no rules earlier.
Right. My favorite way of eating caviar is straight on a spoon, because then you get the full flavor and effect of the burst of the caviar bead against the roof of your mouth. You can enjoy caviar with so many things, but I think the important thing about eating caviar with something else is to be careful to not disguise the flavor of the caviar, not to overwhelm it with other ingredients. So some of the things that go really well with caviar are avocado mousse, for instance. Just having a little spoon with some avocado mousse and a big dollop of caviar on top is lovely. It goes very well, of course, with creme fraiche, with sour cream, the traditional blinis, and so on and so forth. But you can have a lot of fun with caviar and chocolate.
Oh, had no idea.
So we were really laughing at the beginning when you were introducing your sponsor.
Did I say that right? You obviously speak French. Did I say
Ecole
Chocolat correctly?
absolutely perfect. In fact, we are in the process of introducing a series of caviar bonbons.
Huh. Okay, you have to tell us more about
yes.
that.
Yes. And I'm working with a wonderful chocolatier by the name of Susanna Yoon, who used to be the chocolatier at Per Se, and she now has a little shop on Mott Street. And she is developing with me these extraordinary bonbons. And we now have four different types, with all of them with caviar inside.
Wow.
White chocolate, dark chocolate.
When will these be available?
We're hoping the bonbons will be done within the next 2 weeks.
In time for Valentine's Day.
The boxes are unfortunately a little slower to develop. We were aiming for Valentine's Day, and we may have them ready by then.
Okay.
But if not Valentine's, soon thereafter.
Well, keep an eye on our social media. We'll share when those bonbons are ready.
Okay.
And if my boyfriend is listening, I would be very happy with some caviar bonbons for Valentine's Day. Just saying. So we have to jump to the speed round. We could probably talk to you about caviar and your travels and your career and everything for a lot longer, but we're going to jump to the speed round. So, Alex, coffee or tea?
Tea.
I lost the speed round questions. This is not so speedy. Coffee or tea, what's in your fridge?
Let's see, last night we had fresh scallops. We have chicken, lots of fresh vegetables, and lots of cheese.
Is there lots of caviar in there?
No.
I would hope no.
Never keep caviar at home.
Oh, really?
Never.
Why not?
Well, you could go broke really easily with a fridge full of caviar. It's just a discipline that I have. I actually do have a caviar fridge at home.
Uh-huh.
In a separate part of the house, and it does have caviar, but it's not in our personal kitchen.
Okay, okay. I would imagine there's a lot of pressure on when friends come over, and it's like, oh, we got an invitation from Alex.
Right,
where's
exactly.
the caviar?
And we do caviar for special occasions, but because it's my business, and I taste it all the time, I don't sit around and offer caviar to my friends for dinner every night, no.
All right, back to the speed round. What is your favorite food?
Pizza.
What? That's right, you said that. Is there such thing as caviar pizza? I feel like I've seen that before.
You know, I have seen photos of it. We've never tried it, but I do know that someone's done that.
That sounds good. Least favorite food?
Liver.
Do you cook?
Yes.
What is your favorite cookbook?
Gosh, I really don't use cookbooks anymore. The books that I've always carried with me, beginning from the very beginning, I would say, Elizabeth David, James Beard, The River Cafe Girls, Marcella Hazan. But I honestly, you know, having used cookbooks now for so long, I just cook.
Well, that's the point of cookbooks, I guess, right?
Mm.
They want you to sort of take from them and then do it on your own.
Yes.
Place you'd love to travel to next?
I'd probably want to go to what I consider one of my two homes, one of which is Venice, and the other one is East Africa.
Great answers. Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us today and educating us a bit on the world of caviar. We are going to take a quick station break, and we'll be right back with Joy the Baker.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thank you. Love chocolate? Turn your passion into a profession with École Chocolat School of Chocolate Arts. This award-winning school offers many programs for chocolate making so you can master techniques and gain the expertise and business knowledge you need to become a professional chocolate maker. You'll create mouth-watering chocolate recipes from professional instructors while interacting with your classmates and tutors all online. Become a chocolate expert with École Chocolat via your computer, phone, or tablet. Pursue your passion for chocolate. Visit écolechocolat.com today. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. Our next guest is someone you're probably familiar with. Joy the Baker is one of the most popular bloggers around. She's the author of 2 best-selling cookbooks, and she recently made a splash with Drake on Cakes, a fun Instagram account she'll tell us about in a minute. Speaking of Drake, I asked Joy to call me on her cell phone, so we could chat today. Hi, Joy. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
A great joke right off the bat. I love it. Hi, Carrie.
Thank you for laughing. I was worried about making that joke. So how are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm in the middle of shooting my brunch cookbook right now. So I just, like, in the kitchen is about 3 pounds of shrimp and grits.
Oh, my.
And some brioche, like chocolate chip brioche bread that I'm going to turn into cinnamon rolls as soon as we get off the phone. So
chocolate,
I'm doing great.
Chocolate brioche cinnamon rolls.
Yeah.
That is
like, I'm a nuisance.
Wow. Wow. Well, I loved your last cookbook, so I can't wait for this one. When's it coming out?
It's not coming out until March 2017, so time to be hungry for brunch.
Exactly. So are you calling in from New Orleans?
Yeah, I'm calling, and I'm living in New Orleans right now.
That's your home base these days. How's life in the Big Easy?
I whenever anyone asks me how I like New Orleans, I ask them if they've ever been to visit. Have you ever been to visit?
I was there last summer for the Southern Foodways Alliance Summer Symposium.
Okay. So it's a crazy place. And it's hard to describe the, like, how everything is sort of falling down, but growing back. And, like, there's just an energy here that is palpable. So it's going well. I like it.
New Orleans is definitely the most unique place in America. I love New York.
It's like living in a different country sometimes.
It really is.
Like I feel like I don't know what the rules are very often.
I was sad I had only been there.
You can drive the wrong way down a one-way street, and it's like people will understand. Like, you must have a good reason for it, so you can get away with it. It's just nuts sometimes.
I thought you were about to say that's legal. I was like, wow, things really are different in New Orleans. But yeah, if the listeners out there haven't visited New Orleans, you really have to put it on your bucket list. I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed that was my first trip there, because when I got there, you really do realize, like, this is a place unlike any other place in America, and probably unlike any other place on the planet.
Very much. It's very unique. There's a lot. I think it is, like, it has been such an insular city to itself. Like, people grow up here and don't leave, because why would you want to leave? There's a certain magic here. And so it has a lot of French and Spanish influence that is really stuck in the architecture and in the people and in the culture. It's like things are just slow here. I stood in line you stand in line for like long times for things here, and you don't get mad about it because there's no use. It's just the pace of the city.
It's the opposite of New York. You get angry about everything here. So
yeah.
So let's talk about baking and cake and dessert. So even though those things are such a big part of your professional life today, you did not grow up in a household filled with such things. Your parents were health food fans, right?
Oh my gosh. Yes. My parents were, I feel like they were early adopter health food people. Like, it was in the very early 80s when health food was, first of all, health food included a lot more not healthy things, like lots of cheese. Not that cheese is unhealthy, but like a lot of cheese and tofu and these very strange rices that I still to this day don't know what they were. And things sweetened with dates, which when you're 5 years old is not an Oreo cookie. And so, yeah, we had like whole wheat fig bars was the cookie in our house, which according to me was not a cookie at all. And so I taught myself how to bake simply because I wanted to eat brownies. And that was the way to it.
So you had told me once upon a time about an aunt who taught you how to cook. Tell me about her.
My Aunt Dee Dee. Yeah, my Aunt Dee Dee is, she's no longer with us, but she was a school teacher in her day. And while she was teaching, she had a brain tumor. which I guess happens to people sometimes, and it blinded her. So she lost her sight, and she was no longer able to teach. But she had always had this love for baking, and so she would bake, like, even without her sight, she would bake. And so she taught me how to bake, along with my father, who's an avid home baker. But my Aunt Dee Dee taught me a lot about how things feel, like how ingredients feel, because she couldn't see them. And granted, like, her cakes were definitely, you could tell that a blind person baked them. They were kind of crazy looking, sometimes a little burnt on the side. But she had this really acute sense of how ingredients were supposed to feel. And that was, like, that was one of the ways I learned how to bake, which is really sweet.
Do you think it made you a more instinctual baker?
I think it was one of the things that made me a more instinctual baker, for sure. And I think another thing is that I've worked as a professional baker, and just being around ingredients so often every day, you hone your instincts.
So do you feel like baking still intimidates a lot of people? You'll definitely meet people who are like, oh, I love to cook, but I don't bake. And
right.
it's hard to tell why. What is the fear over baking?
Well, I think baking requires precision, some precision, and there is a recipe that you have to follow, because there are techniques that people, I think, just don't really realize the science behind, you know, why you cream butter and sugar, why you add eggs and beat them for 1 minute after you add them to the batter. Things like that you have to, you just have to understand to be successful in baking.
Mm-hmm.
unless you're, let me rephrase. Like, you can follow a recipe word for word and probably have great success, or you can have a feel for it and just understand how ingredients come together. And so without the feel, you definitely have to read the recipe, and that can be intimidating to people.
Yeah, I guess because the cooking, you can wing it. Baking, not so
yeah.
much. So
you have to know, it takes time to know where you can wing it in baking and where you can't.
Right.
That's the deal.
So another part of your history that I love is the influence of Ben and Jerry's on your life. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. Oh, every time I think about Ben and Jerry's, I think about how much I stressed my parents out when I went to work for them. I worked for Ben and Jerry's. Like, I've always worked in the food industry, and when you work in the food industry, it starts very unceremoniously, probably in like a fast food something or other. So my first food job was at a Ben and Jerry's in a food court in a mall, and it was fantastic.
And that was in Los Angeles?
In Los Angeles, yeah. And while I was deciding what to do for college, I decided that instead of going to college straight from high school, I was going to quit everything, move to Vermont, and work for Ben and Jerry's, because that's what I had done in Los Angeles in a food court. So it seemed like the best idea.
So you were talking scoop shop, not like corporate level Ben and Jerry's.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I had to wear a hat and a tie-dye shirt, and I would scoop your ice cream and then charge you $3 for it.
So how did your parents react to that?
They were like, very simply, they were like, absolutely not, you're not doing that. Very simple. You're going to college like a normal human being. Not a normal human being, but like the person that we decided that you are, and you are going to college. I was like, actually, no, I'm definitely moving to Vermont in 2 months, and I'm really going to do that. And so I did. I moved to Vermont, and I worked for Ben and Jerry's on Cherry Street. They're like main scoop shop in Burlington, Vermont. And I would scoop ice cream, but I would also decorate their ice cream cakes and do a few like ice cream wedding cakes. And I mean, it was fantastic. I was so cold. I've never been so cold in my life moving from Los Angeles to Vermont for a winter. I was like, oh, this is real. This is real. I don't have a coat.
How popular was ice cream in the dead of winter in Burlington, Vermont, of all places?
Well, it wasn't unpopular. I think people are used to the cold, and they think might as well.
And I have to ask.
And I ate a lot of ice cream because it was free. It was like an ice cream diet. Those were some good days.
Since you were in Burlington, I guess that was when Bernie Sanders was mayor, right?
Oh, gosh. I should have known who was mayor then.
Or maybe he had moved on to senator at that point. But did you ever cross paths with Bernie?
Bernie and I never met. I never scooped him ice cream, to my knowledge.
I don't know if Joy the Baker's ready to endorse any candidates yet for office, but now's your chance, Joy, if you want to endorse anybody.
Well, if Bernie Sanders would like some ice cream, I'd be very happy to scoop it for him.
So let's talk about your big jump from food service to blogging, because everybody loves bloggers today. But one of the big questions is, how do you make a living as a blogger? So how did you make that leap?
Well, sometimes it's a leap and sometimes it's like a giant shove off of a cliff, I think. I started blogging in 2008 when not very many people were doing it. I like went from my live journal where I would complain about being a waitress to like having a blog. And it started because I had gotten fired, actually. And this story has the two times that I've gotten fired in it, I just realized. Okay, so I had gotten fired from a bakery I worked in, and I was at home baking all the time because it was what I loved to do. I just wasn't getting paid to do it at the time because I had been let go from a job. And I picked up my cell phone, like a little brick cell phone back in the day, and took pictures of what I was baking and posted it online with a recipe and a little story about, I mean, who knows what. And that's how the blog started. And I had the blog for several years, four or so years. And I would blog, have a little bit of advertising on my website, but then have jobs. Like I was a waitress, a cheesemonger, a baker also. So I would have two or three jobs at a time in the food service industry and also just keep up with my blog because I actually loved it so much. And I was down to one cheesemonger job, and I got fired from that. I'm not a totally irresponsible person. I got fired, and I was like, what am I going to do? I was sitting at my computer, I remember very well, about to print out resumes, like update and print out my resume. And I was just like, I don't have the heart for this. I just don't have the heart for this right now. And I think I should try to blog full time. And so I took all of my expenses way down. I moved out of my apartment. I moved in with roommates who were very bizarre people. I like got rid of everything that I had decided I needed, like my gym membership, my cable, you know, like I just pared it down very, very much so I could live off the small amount that my blog was making. And I just hustled it, and I've been hustling the blog ever since.
How did you find advertisers so early on?
I found advertisers through an ad network, you know, one of those networks that gives you advertising, takes a percentage of the money. And so it's nothing that I run myself or have ever run myself. I just like raise my hand and ask someone to help me with it.
I forgot about those good old ad networks. So I sometimes feel that the secret to blogging is persistence, because you really you have to be doing it every other day, and just be on top of it all the time. And I see a lot of people lose interest, like the blog hasn't been updated in a week, a month, whatever. What would you say?
Absolutely. I mean, as unglamorous as it sounds, it's consistency and persistence. And like, you have to be willing to say things when no one is listening, because for a long time, no one will be listening and no one will care. And maybe they'll start to care and maybe they'll stop caring somewhere down the line. So you have to just have this compulsion and consistency in blogging. And it helps if you have a voice that you're comfortable with and that, you know, feels true to you. But yeah, you just have to be there all the time.
So speaking of people listening, you have been blogging for years, and then you decide to do this funny little Instagram account called Drake on Cakes, and it blows up literally overnight.
Gosh, That was weird.
Tell us all about Drake on Cakes. How'd that come about?
Drake on Cake. Well, I haven't actually talked to anyone about Drake on Cake, so...
Oh, really?
Thanks for asking
me
about it.
Okay, you're welcome.
No, people have been, like, emailing and asking me about it. And I'm like, well, it's, you know, Drake. He's a rapper slash genius poet slash very interesting, handsome person who has this crazy life. Turns out his name rhymes with cake. I know a lot about cake. Let's just somehow meld these two together. And that's what it is. I thought of it probably sometime last year and just have been like just sitting on the idea until one day I was like, I'm going to do this. So I went down to Rouse's, which is our like big grocery store here, bought a sheet cake from their bakery and wrote on it, like just wrote some Drake lyrics on it. And I did, I gathered a few cakes before I put the Instagram up. But I don't know, I felt like in my head, I was like, this is clever and really funny to me. This is very funny to me and me alone. And so I just will start it. And that like very simply, I was like, I am entertained by this. Maybe someone else will be. And people are.
And 50,000 followers later. Yes, lots of people are. So wait, you don't even bake the cakes?
Oh, that's the best part for me. No, they are beautiful store-bought treasures that either I write lyrics on or I ask bakery people who give me the strangest looks to write lyrics on.
Oh my gosh, and that's funny.
That's it. I mean, it's such a simple, silly thing that, no, I don't bake the cakes. I don't bake the cakes.
I love it. That's kind of the most brilliant part, that Joy the Baker does not bake the cakes on Drake on Cakes.
The most brilliant part, yeah, the most brilliant part is that because I'm Joy the Baker, people just assume that I bake the cakes. I'm like, oh gosh, thank you. But no.
I will say, I was looking at one of them. I'm like, oh, I wonder if she's posting the recipes online. I guess not.
No, the recipe is drive to Rouse's, befriend the bakers there, and get all the cakes you want.
Oh my gosh, so funny. All right, well, Joy, we have to jump to the speed round, so I have a few quick questions for you. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
How do you take it?
Black.
What's in your fridge right now?
2 Drake on Cakes. Oh, God, there's so much in my fridge right now. 2 Drake on Cakes, 3 dozen eggs, 3 pounds of butter, a lot of buttermilk, pancake batter, parsley, chives, sourdough starter. That's what's in my fridge.
All right. Your favorite food?
Hot dogs with sauerkraut.
Mm. A food you'll never eat?
I'll eat anything.
Okay, good answer.
I would prefer not to eat testicles.
I feel the same way about brains. I kind of draw the line of brains. I don't know.
Okay.
Feels right. Favorite cookbook?
Favorite cookbook? Dory Greenspan's Baking.
Oh, we love Dory Greenspan here.
Yeah.
Favorite food icon?
Julia.
Place you'd love to travel to next?
I want to go to Italy. I'm taking Italian lessons that I've never been and I really want to go.
Oh, wow. How are the... Tell us something in Italian.
Ci vediamo presto. That means we'll see each other soon.
Oh, I hope so. That's a good way to end. You know, we've never met in person, but I'm such a big...
No, we haven't, but I feel like we have.
We've talked on the phone a lot at this point, but anytime you're in New York, you have an open invitation to come to Radio Cherry Bomb, so please come visit us when you're here.
I absolutely will. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Good luck with the new cookbook. We can't wait to see it next year.
Thank you. I hope to talk to you soon.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Big chocolate kisses to our new sponsor, Ecole Chocolat. Make sure to check out the different classes they offer at ecolechocolat.com. If chocolate is your passion, you might just want to make it your profession. And thank you for listening. You're the bomb. Bye, everybody. Boys and girls are on fire now. Boys and girls are on fire.
This is Maggie Seiden, producer of Beer Sessions Radio. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Clodagh McKenna. Clodagh is the bomb because she is leading the charge of the Irish food revolution.